Six music.
BBC Radio. Six Music Documentaries.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time, where we look at the pivotal first moments that made some of our most influential musicians who they are today. On today's show, we have a man known by many names, Charles Michael Kittredge Thompson IV, Black Francis, Frank Black, but regardless of his title, he's made an indelible mark on music, both as a singer with the Pixies and as a solo artist. Few people have pursued their musical vision with the passion and purpose of Mr. Black Francis, and I'm pleased to have him here. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess I just won't stop. Doesn't matter how unsuccessful a particular season is. I just keep trying. I keep trying. I love it. I just don't want to go back to a day job.
So let's talk about the first things all the way through your career. The first question we do ask everyone here is, when was the first time you were even aware of music? When you were very, very small.
Like most people, I'm sure, before my memory allows me to look back, but I can think back to about age 5 or something, you know, I think. I have certain pivotal musical memories.
Which artists do you remember hearing?
Peter, Paul, and Mary, Donovan, what's her name? I got a brand new pair of roller skates, you got a brand new key. That's Melanie, I think.
Yes, it is indeed.
Yeah, we had a little Melanie 45 in our house.
Did you connect hearing that music with something that you wanted to create? Did you hear it and think, I'd like to make that?
Well, in fact, there was a memory like that, but it doesn't really involve an artist or a song. But there was a guy who I now understand was playing the drums, but I didn't know what they were at that time. But he used to practice across the street from where I lived. And I was too afraid to look into the basement window when he was in there. But when he was not there, I would go over and I would take a look in the window. And I saw this blue sparkly thing, which I now know is a drum set. But I knew that whatever that was, whatever was going on there, I wanted to be involved in that, whatever involved that thing. And then I think soon after that, I got my first sort of introduction to a drum kit by a jazz musician at a cocktail lounge where my mother was a waitress. And she introduced me to him, and he knew I was interested in this, what I then knew was called the drums. And then
glamorous object.
Yes.
What was the first record you actually owned? Can you remember having that first piece of vinyl that was yours in your hand? What was it?
Well, I think it was inherited, and it was left by the previous tenant of the home where we were at in another city, maybe a couple of years after that. And that would have been a copy of, it was probably Donovan's Greatest Hits or something like that. But it was mostly focused on the Mellow Yellow track.
I'm just mad about saffron. Well, saffron's mad about me. I'm just mad about saffron. She's just mad about me. They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow. About 14, 14's mad about me. I'm just mad about 14. She's just mad about me. They call me Mellow Yellow. They call me Mellow Yellow. Quite rightly, they call me Mellow. A wind of a velocity nil. Wanna have forever to fly. If you want your cup, power fill. They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow. Sudden grace. Electrical banana. It's about to be the very next phase. They call it Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow.
First guitar, I can remember.
A nylon string classical guitar that was belonged to my mother that she purchased, I think for about $100. She used to steal my father's loose change tips. He was worked in the bar business, and so he used to throw his tips up into a closet shelf, and she used to pilfer that for her own little fund, and then she bought herself a guitar, and then she played the guitar a little bit, and then my cousin, who took care of me and my brother for a while when my mother was very ill for a period. He learned how to play guitar for some years on that. And the guitar was out of my life. And then somehow that same guitar in another city came back to me. And then I don't know whatever happened to the guitar. It was lost or something, or we sold it. I don't know what happened to it. But then when I was about 12, I suppose, I began to play it.
Can you remember writing your first song?
Yeah, it was a multi-stanzaed, you know, epic kind of song. It was about the Beatles, written in kind of a cryptic kind of story kind of style, I think. I don't remember what it sounded like or what the words were, but that was my first song, I think.
Can you remember what it was called?
No. I wish I did.
I told you about strawberry fields. You know the place where nothing is real. Well, here's another place you can go.
Was songwriting easy at that age?
Yeah, I think so. I had quite a few songs pretty quickly, including stuff that I think ended up on, like, you know, early Pixies records, you know.
Your songwriting is always kind of, you've always kind of honed in on kind of various subjects and themes all throughout your writing career. Can you remember what your first obsessions were, the first kind of things? I mean, you mentioned the Beatles there, but what were the other kind of things that you were very preoccupied with early on?
Well, mostly early on, obsessions would have been a lack of them. You know what I mean? It's more focus on things like rhyme scheme and abstraction and something, coming up with something that sounded interesting. You know what I mean? That was sounded haunting or creepy or scary or crazy or whatever. You know what I mean? You know, the notion that you have to have subject matter for a song is sort of a foreign kind of concept to me, because if you grow up listening to Donovan or listening to the Beatles, if you really, of course, we all know what I Want to Hold Your Hand is about, but everybody quickly outgrows I Want to Hold Your Hand and they move on to the heavier stuff. And as soon as you move on to the heavier stuff, the subject matter becomes indiscernible or difficult or abstract or obviously about the sound of the language, you know what I mean? And so this is my model. And the whole notion that, like, well, let's sing about something, what's it about, is not the first place that I go. I can go there now, especially because I'm a practiced songwriter, but that the idea that that is what you're supposed to do is not my first choice or whatever. And I think that isn't the case for other people, because their starting place is a different place, and their starting place comes from a more narrative place, a place that has plot, a place that has meaning or significance. This is a song about this, especially, I would say, in the last 30 years or something. I think that the things like, you know, political music or spiritual music, or the fact that people have this notion that, oh, songwriters are some sort of beacon of positive energy and they've got to convey something really important either from their heart or from the annals of humanity. You know what I mean? There's all this, and I realize I'm kind of poking fun at it a little bit, but you know what I mean? It's just sort of like that to say that that's the way that it is. That's the way that's the ideal or whatever. It's just a made up rule. It doesn't there are no rules, you know. And if you listen to a child speak or a child sing, they're not concerned with these things. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of primal things that are probably, if there are any rules, they therein is the are the rules the in the primal area, not in the intellectual area, cerebral area.
In 1986, you formed the Pixies with Kim Deal, David Lovering, and Joey Santiago. Can you remember the first rehearsal that you played together? Remember the first time you played with each other?
Well, with all four Pixies, because I was playing with Joey before we got the other two. It was either at a rehearsal space in the Boston area that I had rented, or it may have been at David Lovering's family's home north of Boston in a garage. His father was a painter, and so they had sort of this space that was open for rehearsing. So I think we used to go to practice there when we were in between rehearsal spaces, kind of. Because sometimes we were in a room, you know, in a warehouse with lots of other bands, or sometimes we were out there in the suburbs.
Was it a good experience playing together quite early on? Did it feel like you were musically achieving what you wanted to achieve quite early on, or did it take a bit of work to kind of get there, to translate the songs into a band environment?
Well, when you have a band in a, you know, in most cities, I imagine, I don't know what it's like in every city, I suppose, but, you know, you beg and you plead to get a slot on a Monday night or a Tuesday night, and they encourage you to bring people, and usually they ask when people come to the door to hear a bunch of nobody bands, which nobody band are you here to see, and they try to get an assessment of how many drinkers you've pulled in. And then you know, if things go well, not based on the aesthetics of your show, but probably more based on how many drinkers you brought into the room, will determine whether or not you get asked back and what night and at what time slot. So we started off on last band of nobodies on a Tuesday night, which meant there must have been some sort of aesthetic choice made by the booker. In other words, they put us on last. They thought we sounded lively, maybe based on our tape or whatever it was that we had given them. And we were asked back on a Friday night, you know, in the middle of the set. So we instantly moved from a kind of beginner slot to a more intermediary slot. And we kind of just kept moving on from there pretty fast. So we got out of town, and it took us about a year to get out of town from like the first rehearsals and recordings to going on tour and that kind of thing. We about a year. '87, Come On Pilgrim. This was the first thing that we released.
An enjoyable record to make?
Yeah, it was in a warehouse, and we were told not to go out after dark, and they clamped down and locked the warehouse to protect whoever was inside of it, and we brought our sleeping bags, and we camped out there for about 3 days and made our first record.
It took a while for the record to kind of get paced, didn't it, that particular album? Did you feel that you were doing something important straight away? You were just that the audience was there waiting for you. You just had to reach them.
I don't know. I mean, we were all pretty happy. I mean, you know, I gave notice at my job at another warehouse. the first time I saw the artwork for the first disc, which would have only been available on import there in the United States. This is in the fall of 1987. So as soon as I got the proof or whatever of the artwork, I gave my notice that day. That was good enough for me. And we hit the road and played to probably small crowds for a few months. And then shortly thereafter, made a record and we were going to England and Holland and Germany, whatever. So as far as we were concerned, it was all pretty rosy. I don't know that it really was, but you understand, I wasn't working at the warehouse and I was on my way to Europe. So good enough for me. I mean, you know what I mean? And I haven't really looked back since.
In 1989, you worked on Doolittle with Gil Norton for the first time. How did that relationship work? Because you worked with him at various points.
I don't know that we had any kind of method. He maybe had some methods because he was an experienced producer and we were an inexperienced band. So we were rough on the edges and he was a pop producer, a British pop producer. And that's different than an American pop producer, I would say, in general. And so that was a good match because it kind of spiffed us up a little bit for people that had more pop ears, but because we were pretty rough, it still had a kind of naivete, it still had a roughness that sort of the fans of that sort of thing, it still had enough of that, that we held on to them from our previous two releases. So that was kind of it kind of climaxed or came together. It's a synchronicity, you know, I guess is what happened. To date, that is our most successful record. It's definitely the most successful record in my entire catalog.
Turns blue. I know.
Here comes your man from the Pixies' Doolittle album.
Six Music.
Six Music.
You're listening to Do You Remember the First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Black Francis. Welcome back.
Thank you.
It was during the making of Trompe Le Monde in 1991 that you apparently started considering the idea of making your first solo album. Is that right?
It sounds about right, yeah.
What were your reasons for embarking on a solo career for the first time?
Just ego and kind of boredom and, you know, tired of feeling sick to your stomach because of all the tension in the room or whatever, or on the bus, you know. So it's a natural enough progression, you know. Every band gets 5 years, and after that, things start to kind of fall apart. And, you know, usually it's the singer who decides, hey, I can go do my own record, actually. I don't need you guys. And that's what you do.
First record, your first solo record, Frank Black in 1992. Was it difficult to step out the shadows of, you know, of the Pixies? Because Pixies cast a big shadow. Do you feel nervous about doing it on your own?
Not particularly. You know, you have your, maybe your, you know, you have one kind of crucial humbling experience coming from a lofty place to a more, crappy place.
What was yours?
You know, playing at some, you know, I was in some, a beach town called Grover Beach, which is just south of Pismo Beach, which is just south of San Luis Obispo, which is just south of San Francisco. And I believe they serve seafood at the venue and or Italian food or something. And, you know, plywood stage, and then the waitress kind of yelling at you to be quiet because people are still eating, you know what I mean? And then you realize, oh, okay, this is where I am. This is where I am in my life. This is reality. And then, you know, it hurts for a second, but then it's kind of, you know, it's kind of charming at the same time because you're in a beautiful little obscure place that you would never be if you were in a big band. And so, you know, I didn't pay my dues, so to speak, the first time around. So it became time to pay my dues, and I did.
They all sleep their heads in.
lots of your songs around that time were kind of, there was this science fiction theme. We talked a bit about themes before. Can you remember seeing your first UFO?
Yeah, I was about aged 6, I think. Six or seven even. And it was a long cylindrical rocket shape kind of thing, missile shaped. It was in broad daylight, and it was, my brother and I were playing in the mud, and we stopped what we were doing, and we looked up, and there was this object not so high above the ground, probably could be measured in hundreds of feet, probably, as opposed to thousands of feet. And it was completely silent, without markings. Didn't have wings or anything like that, you know. So it was like totally classic, pencil-shaped cigar. It wasn't cigar-shaped, it was missile-shaped. And it moved very slowly, like a bird would fly, you know, not like a, you know, it was a silent, slowly moving silver object moving slowly over us, over the house, over the yard, and it moved on down the road. And then we went back to playing in the mud, and that was the first time I saw something.
Teenager of the Year, which is a solo record that came out in 1994. I was kind of, I suppose, the first big kind of hit you had as a kind of solo artist, I suppose. I mean, it's a lot of songs on that record. You said you found it quite easy to be prolific early on. Has that kind of kept up with you? Have you always kind of felt the need to write and write a lot? As it's been like an ongoing process that happens all the time? Because some people find it quite hard to write that many songs in one go.
I find it quite important or necessary to continue to be a rock musician guy, you know. I think that's really my motivation, as opposed to I need to get something out of me. I have this song and it must be heard. I must sing it from the rooftops. You know, it doesn't really feel like that to me. I know it does feel like that to other people, but to me, it strictly comes down to being in a band or being like Donovan, you know what I mean? To be that, you know, whatever you want to call that, you know. Troubadour is a nice word that we've borrowed from history. It's sort of a misnomer when you hear about troubadours, I suppose, and what their experience was like. It was different, but I suppose it's the same thing. I don't know. You know, you traveling around and playing songs, you know. I guess just troubadours seem to probably had a lot more rules. So it's just that that doesn't exist anymore. So we're calling, some of us call ourselves troubadours. I mean, I like that notion. I like reading about the troubadours.
That's an interesting work ethic. As you say, there is this kind of division between the slightly more sort of pretentious way of approaching songwriting and this, as you say, a slightly more direct ethic. Where do you think you get that from? Is that your kind of parents or your own sort of background? What?
I don't know. Like I said, you know, if you have a pivotal moment where you see a blue sparkly drum set and, you know, you decide, you know, it's self-identification, you know, and whether it's just something that you told yourself when you were a little kid and it eventually became true, or whether it is sort of tapping into something that's bigger than you, you know, I don't know which it is, but that's how it feels to me. It's, you know, when did you decide you want to become a musician? I mean, I've been asked that many times over the years, and the more I've been asked it, the more I answer it, and the more I think about it, the more I realize, well, I didn't decide necessarily. Unless you want to talk about some sort of moment when I was very young. I mean, I don't certainly think that my children can make decisions, you know what I mean? I tend to have an adult view often, you know, when they're trying to decide on something, they can't make a choice. They're just kids. They can't figure that out. I've got to figure that out for them, you know. But having said that, also they say that a child is sort of who he is by the time he's age 5, in terms of their psychology, you know, their personality, their makeup, you know. It's all whatever happens before you're 5, you know, that's the input, and then the rest is the output. So somewhere along the line, there was an identification, self-identity. So when did I want to become a musician and a songwriter and a singer? I have always been.
I'm a horse so lost in the shade.
In 1997, you formed Frank Black and the Catholics. Did you miss the band dynamic? Was that the reason behind putting that kind of banner over it?
For me, it was more about probably the way that we recorded. We made about 5 or 6 records. It was probably, yeah, more about whatever rules that we came up for ourselves, or that I came up for us to follow. And that basically had to do with the type of recording that we did, which was analog and live to 2-track tape.
Are you easy to be in a band with?
I think that it's easy for some people, and I think it's not easy for other people. It just all depends on the chemistry between the people. I just got a little note this morning from a drummer friend of mine who I did one tour with many years ago. In the Catholics, actually, he was replacing the regular drummer who couldn't be there for some reason on a tour, and he just sent me a little note this morning saying, yeah, gosh, my memories of that little tour we did is still the highlight of my musical career, you know, and I was really touched that he, you know, that our little tour was so special to him. So he really liked working with me. But it's a personality thing. We see each other and, you know, we're, you know, it's all hugs and kisses and it's this big gooey affair, you know what I mean? And it's not really based on anything particular. His personality isn't necessarily like my personality, but we just like each other, you know?
Sky is blue, you got everything to do,
Pixies announced the formation in 2003 and got back together again early.
I didn't announce it.
Really?
The Pixies didn't announce it. Some radio station close by here announced it for, I guess, because they were having a laugh. I sort of created the situation because they were asking me about something and then I was being sarcastic and I thought it was obvious that I was being sarcastic. I thought being British, they would appreciate my obvious sarcasm. But instead of appreciating my sarcasm, they turned it on me, I suppose because they're British. And they made it into like a legitimate, like, you know, statement from my mouth. You know what I mean? That I said something. And then they proceeded to like re-announce it everywhere. And then suddenly it was like in, you know, I think it was on like CNN, for God's sakes. It was like, it was ridiculous. You know what I mean? And so it kind of like, it kind of created this whole fantasy. But then, I don't know, I was in the right space mentally at that time. So I just kind of called up the band and said, well, you know, I didn't really say that, but you know, what the heck? You wanna do it?
What was the first gig like? What was the first gig when you played together as the Pixies like? You must be able to remember.
Yeah,
that's strange.
Yeah, it was in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It was great. I mean, I just sort of felt like it was just, oh, hi. You know, it was just sort of like continuing on from where it had been. You know what I mean? It wasn't, that's kind of how it is with those guys and ladies. You know what I mean? It's, it just sort of, oh, this, you know, I don't think there's a lot of kind of poignant reflection going on among the band. I think it just sort of feels normal. I mean, it's fun. It's great. But I mean, you know what I mean? It isn't like a compare and contrast, you know, perspective, you know what I mean? Inner thought. I mean, I think it's just sort of like, oh, so well, that was fun. When's the next show?
Tell me about the new record.
It's called Nonstop Erotic, and it was recorded in LA and New York a little bit, and mostly recorded right here in London at a studio called Rack Studios. That's where we did all the vocals and keyboards, and it was mixed there. And a kind of a famous older studio, not so old. I mean, it's from like about 1970 or so, I think, you know, and it was a studio that was owned by the late Mickey Most, record producer. And anyway, it's got a real vibe. And plus it's around the corner from Paul McCartney's favorite cafe. So I was always kind of going over there, you know, hoping that I would get to see Paul McCartney having his toast, you know. But anyway, I never did.
On Nonstop Erotic, on the new album, reading some of the sort of accompanying material that you kind of posted online, it seems to be, it's a sexually themed record. Is this kind of, was this your sort of mindset, your kind of obsession, your subject matter for the recording and writing of this album?
Yes.
Good answer. How come from UFOs to religion to whatever, do you now find your kind of headspace in a more sexual place?
I don't know. I'm just in the Chinese zodiac. I'm a snake. And so when I discovered I was a snake, it sort of explained a lot of things about my life and personality. And so it became a concept that I embraced. The snake is instinctive or whatever, or I don't know if instinctive is the right word, is reactionary and kind of reacts in the moment, is on his belly, feels his way. He feels his way, you know, and he doesn't have artistic vision, if you know what I mean. He just is alive in the moment. If you're walking in through the woods and you come across a snake, what does a snake do? He either bites you or he scurries off into the bush. You know what I mean? He just reacts. That's how a snake is. And that's how I am. And I just react in the moment. So I don't have things in my head. You know what I mean? Or at least not the future or the past. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? I'm just kind of like doing it. And that's natural to me. And if I try to have too much vision, it doesn't feel right to me. It doesn't feel right to me. And some artists are not snakes, and they don't act very snaky.
So that was the increasingly reptilian Frank Black. We'll leave you with something from Frank's newest album, Nonstop Erotic.
music.
What can we expect from Weekend Breakfast?
The lid of laughs or the piano of pranks or something.
With hummus crisps, mini party rings, half a tub of coleslaw.
This is Radcliffe and Maccone.
We hit the ground Usain Bolt-like sprinting.
If you want relaxed and convivial chat, where else are you going to go?
Be quite interesting, okay, though, isn't it? So there's a knock on the door and you open it and it's Sting with the snake round his neck. Well, this is a moment, isn't
this
it?
This is a moment I won't forget. I bought a new doorbell yesterday, Mark.
Oh, great. Is this a joke?
Not really. Well, providers with the punchline to that.
I bought a new doorbell yesterday. Missed the delivery, though.
Radcliffe and Maccone.
Every weekend morning from 7. I see some standards have slipped. Do we not have to wear a tie anymore?
No, you can just wear this velour one piece.
Yeah. Six Music.
My mind.